Okay, good afternoon. Shalom Aleichem. We continue the men's afternoon kollel, as Rabbi Shabtai just mentioned, 4 days a week. Thank you to the Achbamas for sponsoring and the Frohlich Financial Group for sponsoring and underwriting the men's afternoon kollel at the Boca Raton Synagogue, the Dr. Yitzchak Belazan Beis Medrash, every afternoon, 4 afternoons a week. Super excited to continue our learning. So we are continuing a series that we began. This is part 3 on failing to plan is planning to fail, Jewish considerations in wills and estates. And without reviewing everything we've seen until now, but we began with the notion of not only before you get to a will, how we want to bequeath or share our money with the next generation, but starting with the question of an ethical will, of not only giving money, assets, property, but also communicating ideals, values, and making sure that we leave a directive of an ethical will, of what our vision is for our children, our grandchildren, or for anyone whom we want to inherit what we are going to leave them. We talked about what is the right amount to leave for tzedakah versus the right amount to leave for the next generation, and the normal boundary that talks about not giving away too much, lest we become in a position ourselves to need to rely on the community. That normal consideration does not apply to wills and estates, because, of course, after your demise, you no longer have to worry that there'll be no money left for you to live. You'll no longer be among the living, and therefore that's no longer a consideration. We then moved over to the Torah view of the Torah perspective on how money should be divided. And that is, I'm looking at our source sheets. If you're not following the source sheets, I'm happy to provide them for you afterwards. The Torah in Sefer Bamidbar, Perek Chav Zayin, in chapter 27, tells us, in the context of the claim, of the complaint of the Benos Slavcha, that they were excluded from inheriting, the Torah then gives us the parameters, the general hierarchy or framework of the laws of inheritance. And the Shulchan Aruch codifies it in source 15 and tells us, and it goes from a boy through down to a grandson, great-grandson, and if not, to the granddaughter, not up. We went through all the different directions that it goes. And one of the things that we saw is it bears very little resemblance to what people would want to do today. Today, what would be considered fair and equitable to be able to give away our assets to all of our children equally, today we want to include our spouse, is not included in the Torah's prescription for how to bequeath one's assets, one's inheritance to the next generation. And that's what we're going to deal with or discuss as we go further, is how does one, to a certain degree, circumvent that? How does one create a legal loophole to be able to leave the money where we want, how we want, without ignoring, on the one hand, but also simultaneously not being bound by the limitations of what the Torah wants? And one example that we saw, and this is where we left off, is the notion of a bechor. The Torah in Dvarim in Deuteronomy 21:16 tells us, "Kesa bechor ben asnoa yakir lases lo apishnayim bechol shint yimatzei lo ki u reishiso no lo mishpata bechora." He deserves the right of the bechora, of the firstborn, and one of the rights of the firstborn that comes with the firstborn is the male firstborn gets a double portion of the estate. So again, if a person left 3 children, you divide the assets in 4, and the oldest son would get 2 portions, and each of the other children would get only 1 portion. What's called the Bechor is notel pishnayim. He receives a double portion, which the Mishnah in Bechoros in source 17, here in the bottom of page 7, the Mishnah in Bechoros elaborates on as well. Bechor notel pishnayim nechsei av. The firstborn son takes a double share in the father's estate, but not in the mother's estate. And he doesn't take a double portion in shvach, in any improvements made to the estate after the father's death. And lo baroi kavamuchsach, not in the father's prospective assets, the way that he does in the assets that are actually possessed by the father at the time of death. Meaning that the Bechor, and this is a subject bigger than for now, the notion of the Bechor, not only, you know, we just read last week about this, two weeks ago, Makas Bechoros, about the 10th final plague, the culmination of all the plagues, striking down the firstborn, and what that meant, you were striking at the heart of Egypt. The idea of the firstborn takes the place of the parent, of the father. That's how we even describe, they take the place of, they are in the place of, they take on the role of, the responsibility of. And the assumption in antiquity was that the firstborn, because they bore the responsibility towards their siblings, that's why they got the double portion. Not to indulge the firstborn, not to favor the firstborn, not for the firstborn to live in a lap of luxury, but rather, since the firstborn is presumed to take on greater responsibility, they also need the assets in order to be able to be the engine to drive that responsibility, and therefore the Bechor got a double portion. When we talk about the Jewish people, are a Bechor. Bini Bechori Yisrael. The Jewish people as a whole are considered the firstborn to God. Bini Bechori Yisrael. We are the firstborn of God. And the idea of being the firstborn of God is that while God has many children, we're not just among the children of God, we are His firstborn. The firstborn are the role models. The firstborn are the teachers. The firstborn bear the responsibility in order to try to effectuate the vision of the parent. And so, therefore, the firstborn needs to be empowered. Firstborn needs to be able to have the tools to play that role. And that's why the Torah assumes that the firstborn gets a double portion. However, they only get a double portion in the real assets, not in improvements that are made after the estate, after the father's death. They only get it in the actual assets of what the father had at the time he died. But the prospective assets, i.e., if the father had a loan, a debt that was due to him, then the firstborn does not get a double portion in the debt that's due to the father, only in the things the father actually happens. Which leads Rav Avadia Yosef to have the following question. How do you view money in a bank? So cash on hand, if you go through your parents' books or look under their mattress, and you find in the safe in the bottom of their closet, you find cash. So that cash, the bechor, the firstborn, gets a double portion. And that's called muchzak. The father was considered to be holding on to it. The question is, what about that which is in the bank? Rav Avadia Yabia Omer Chelicha says, Odo she'ilasu b'davar mishehifket tzchume kesem b'bank, somebody who deposited money in the bank, api heter iska, they did so legally, that's just tangentially. Rav Avadia is talking about in Israel, banks are owned by Jews and banks pay interest. How do Jews pay Jews interest? Only with a heter iska. That's another legal loophole for another time. V'naflu b'Yerushalof ne'abonim. And now the father who has an account in a particular bank, that father expires. Assuming you're following the Torah's prescription for inheritance, not circumventing it with the tools that we have yet to get to, but assuming one is following the Torah's specific or direct, explicit prescription, which includes the oldest son getting the double portion, do they only get a double portion in the cash that's at home hidden under the mattress? Or do they also get a double portion in the bank accounts? How do we view the money in the bank? Do we view money in the bank as cash on hand? Since when the bank is open, or even if it's not, if you have an ATM card, you could withdraw your money anytime you want, and it's government insured. If you're in a good, reliable bank, your money, your account at that bank is insured, and insured by the government. You can access that money, so therefore it's the equivalent of cash on hand. The money you have in the bank, you might as well have cash under your mattress. Or do you say no? The bank is borrowing your money. When you want it back, they're going to pay you back. And why would you argue the bank is borrowing your money? From the very fact that a bank pays interest. Now, the interest rate is so low, they barely pay you anything. But that happens to be a technicality. If the interest rates were higher, the bank would have happened to pay you a lot more. You'd get more for the fact that the bank is borrowing your money. So how do we view a bank account and the fact that the money is at the bank? Is the bank holding your money, but it's really yours, therefore you're muhsak, and therefore the eldest son gets a double portion in the bank account? Or do we view it that the bank borrowed money and they're going to pay your money back with interest? And true, you can access the money anytime you want. You can call the loan anytime you want. But it's as if they're borrowing it, evidence for the fact that they're paying you at interest. That was the question Rav Avadia is dealing with the very practical difference of, does the firstborn get a double portion? And Rav Avadia has a long discussion. His Tshuvos and Yabia Omer are generally long. Yechav Das is a recording of what he said in the radio program. He was asked questions on the radio. He gave his answers encyclopedic, and it was recorded in Yechav Das. The question, you have the middle, and there's always a sikum. There's the easy summary, the answer. Yabia Omer are as much more developed Tshuvos, very long, very intricate, again, very comprehensive and very developed. So here you see, I skipped to Os Hay. There are four essays first before we get to this fifth one. But he points us to the Shevet Alevi, Shnishla Odos Mos, and Mufkadim Abank, and Yesham Din Royo Muchsuk. That Rav Shevet Alevi, Rav Vosner, was asked a similar question in the Fipshar HaSugya, and he pointed us to a Gemara in Baba Basra. The Milva Chashiva Roy, Mishim Delav Hani Moshab. Shavak Avuon, that a loan is not considered to be actual assets of the father, liquid assets. A loan is considered to be roi, its potential aspects, its prospective assets. Why? Because when you lend money, the loan is meant to be used. Milva lotza nitna, person who borrowed the money, borrowed it to be able to use it. Even though you can call that loan, it's an unusual loan. Normally a loan is for a set period of time. The Gemara Mako says, if you have no specified time, then stam milvish loshim yom. If you didn't specify how long the loan is, it's 30 days. So someone's online next to you at the pizza store, they realize they have no money, they say, can I borrow $20? And you didn't say for how long, you have the right, 30 days. Stam milva is 30 days. A stam loan, if a loan is given, offered for an unspecified amount of time, it's assumed to be for 30 days. Normally, we specify how long a loan is. The bank, it's an unusual loan, because it's a loan that I can call anytime I walk into the bank, anytime I go to the ATM machine. I can get back my money. It's not the same money the father's left me. So when my father had $100 under the mattress, so then the firstborn gets two portions, a double portion of that $100. The father left that $100 bill. That's for us. But the money that he deposited in the bank is not the same money that you get back when you withdraw from the bank. In Israel, we're the only reason, the only way that you're able to take interest is because you're employing the heter iska, shi mechza milva mechza pikadon. How does a heter iska, let's go on a digression for a moment, but an important one. How do Jews lend Jews money? Happens all the time. Jews have lending businesses. There are Jewish-owned banks, brokerage firms, investment firms. How do Jews lend other Jews money? The answer is with a heter iska. Normally, we have a prohibition of ribbis. A Jew is both a prohibition on the lender and on the borrower, biblical prohibition on both. You're neither allowed to lend or borrow with interest. How do you circumvent that? You can't violate a Torah law, but you can structure it differently. And the way we structure it differently, a heter iska does, is it says, oh, this looks like a loan. It's not a loan. It's a loan, but it also is an investment with a return. An investment with a return is different than a loan with interest. Now, you may say that's semantical. What's the difference if you give me $100 and I promise to give you back $110 because I'm giving you 10% interest on the loan? Or what's the difference if you give me $100 to invest in me and I promise you a 10% return, so I'm going to give you $110 back as a return? It sounds like it's semantical, but it's semantical that it works. Of course, there are other details to it. An investment with a return is more reliable and more guaranteed than a loan with an interest. So there are significant differences between them, but the heter iska is structuring it rather, instead of a loan with interest, it's an investment with a return. So therefore, says Rav Ozder, Uvemechza milva shal iska nechliku achronim, ichashiva royo muchzuk. So on the half of the loan, that's in the bank, that's considered a loan, is that royo muchzuk. And he goes on with this discussion. So to skip right to the end, Rav Avadia says the following: Even though that which we lend to a bank is much more secure than the average loan that we give to others, nevertheless, in the end of the day, it's a loan. The pasuk specifically said the bechor gets from asher yimatzei lo, that which is found with the father when he dies. The money that's in the bank is not found with the father when he dies. It's money he lent to the bank. True, a loan he could collect, but money that's lent. And even if you want to say that other loans to individuals are not considered prospective, but are considered liquid, nevertheless, an account in a bank is considered a loan, and therefore the eldest son would not get a double portion in bank accounts. And that is Rav Avadia's conclusion. Bechvod Rav Avadia Yosef Rishon Tzion, Harav HaRashi LeYisrael, at the time the Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel. That is his conclusion. Shulchan Aruch records this. HaBachor Notal Pishnaim, not Rav Avadia, who obviously came much after the Shulchan Aruch, but records this general halacha, that the Bachor, the eldest son, if you're following the specific prescription of the Torah, the eldest son gets a double portion of Benichzei Aviv in the assets of the father. Ketzad, how? Hiniyach Hamisha Banav, he left five sons, Ve'achem Mehem Bachor, and the oldest child is a son, HaBachor Notal Shlisha Mamon, V'cholechem Yarba Pshutim, Notal Shtus, then the Bachor is getting a third, and each of the others is getting a sixth. If he left nine sons, the eldest is getting a fifth and the others are getting a tenth. And that is the way to divide the assets. And that is, in fact, the halacha. Now, interestingly, the Shulchan Aruch tells us, how do you define a bechor for these purposes in terms of who's eligible to get the double portion? So the Shulchan Aruch says, Yotzei Dofen, if the eldest son was born through C-section, cesarean section, Va'ba Acharav, Shneim Einem Bechorim, neither the firstborn son born through C-section, nor the child born naturally but who follows, neither of them are a bechor. Harishon Lefish Lonolod V'Nemar V'Yoldu Lo Banim, the first one is not born. The first one was removed surgically. Halacha sees a C-section as not birth, but being removed surgically, and therefore losing the status of a bechor. And the second, Tasheni Harei Kad Mo'acher, is not the first of the mother, even though the first didn't come out naturally, but the second, who came out naturally, is not the first of the mother, and therefore is not considered to be the bechor. So one of the criteria to be a bechor, to get a double portion, is that it has to be born naturally. And what would make this firstborn son eligible to inherit double portion from the father? If he is the firstborn to the father. The mother could have been married 5 separate times beforehand. The mother could have had 5 firstborn children with the other 5 spouses. But if this is now the firstborn to the father, that's considered to be a bechor, firstborn to the father, and eligible to inherit the double portion of the father. Coming back to our question, so we saw Rav Avadia said money deposited in a bank is considered roli, it's prospective, it is not actual asset, liquid asset of the father, and the firstborn does not get a double portion. What about the question of government bonds? Government bonds, are they structured different than a bank account? A bank account kind of is my money. On the other hand, I'm paid interest, so I've really lent it and I'm getting it back. So you can make the argument both ways. What about government bonds? This is a machlokas between the Noda Bihudur of Yeches Galanda and the Aruch HaShulchan of Yechiel Michal Epstein. The Noda Bihudur was asked, Shelos Chacha Mefapa B'chochma, Iske Nachlos Kibalti, V'inei Mash Nistapek, his question was, Bekamar Obligation, Imekre Roy, O Muchzog L'gabe B'chor. A government obligation, a government bond, is that considered a prospective asset or is that a realized asset in terms of whether the firstborn gets the double portion? And he answers, says the Nodav Yudah, Le'adati makam safek, v'vadai roi mekri. Says, what's the doubt? What's the question? You've lent money to the government. You're getting paid a return on it. It's going to become realized in the future, the bond, when the bond matures. That's considered roi. Until it's matured, it's considered prospective. It's not actual, therefore it's not yours. But the Aruch HaShulchan disagrees. The Hilgar of Yechiel Michal Epstein. And he says the following. He says, Shtar Shel HaMalucha, government bond. Kevin Shehochin Kemad Be'a Gemura Arei Kechomad Be'os V'not Al B'chor Ba'am Pishnayim. He says a government bond, now maybe they were structured differently. I don't know what the law is today. Are you allowed to transact in government bonds? If I owned a bond, can I use it to buy something and transfer the ownership of the bond to another? I don't know what the rule of the law is. I don't know if anybody who's listening does. But the Aruch HaShulchan, at least in his time, was assuming it could. So, you know, again, you take like a check. I don't think in America the minhag is as strong as it is in Israel that people will endorse a check. And, you know, you could have a check that's changed hands 5 times, might have corona on it 4 times by the time you got it, but you could have a check that's been endorsed and been used in 5 makolats to pay for things before it was ever deposited in a bank. That's part of the way it's done in Israel. I don't know the legality of it or the appropriateness of it, but that's the way it's done nonetheless. So the Aruch HaShulchan, Rav Yechiel Michal Epstein, says if you have a bond even before it matures, but you can transfer the bond, you can use the bond as a commodity, as cash. And therefore, it's as if you own it right now. It has a very real value. You can transact in it. And since you can transact in it, it's a very real and present value. Therefore, the eldest son will get a double portion. Again, this is the notion that you're a government bond. So, shtar shel malucha is talking about cash, government cash. But then the next example is shtaros hamalucha shel ribis, where you have a bond that they're paying you interest on, even though you can't transact in the market with it. Your cash actually has no value either. If you think about it, your cash is a piece of paper. It has no value. How much copper is in your penny? How much silver is in your dime? It doesn't have an actual value. It has a symbolic value. So too does a government bond. The paper itself doesn't have an actual value, a symbolic value. So for the Aruch HaShulchan, what's the difference between my $20 bill, where the bill itself doesn't inherent or intrinsically have value, but rather it's what it symbolizes, it's the contract of it. Similarly, a government bond doesn't have an actual value, the piece of paper, but considering it's government-backed, it's as good as collected, therefore it too is considered not roi prospective, but it's considered to be you own it. Essentially, the Aruch HaShulchan is saying that the eldest son doesn't have a right in the double portion in prospective, because it's possible you get, it's possible you won't. The idea of roi means you lent money, there's a debt due to you, you may collect it, you may not collect it. The distinction between roi and muchzak was the likelihood that you'd have it. But when you have something which is prospective, but there's such a confidence that you'll get it, then really we don't treat it as prospective, we treat it as if it's real already, realized already, and therefore it's considered to be muchzak, not considered to be roi. Okay, now the Ramah adds on, that the eldest son does not get a double portion alone. What about a partnership with someone else? That's considered not prospective. That's considered to have right now. The partnership that a father had. So let's say a man dies and he's a partner in an investment. Is that roi or muchzak? That's considered, the Ramah says, that's considered muchzak. That's considered real and realized and present. And the eldest son would get a double portion of it. Okay, so we talked about, again, we're talking now about the Torah's formula, not what we want to do, not how we would want to leave things today. And Shalom Bayis plays an enormous role. We want to do things in an equitable fashion in order to, as best as possible, avoid conflict and tension, animosity later. But we're still working with the Torah's formula, the Torah's prescription. The eldest son gets a double portion, and now we have explored when and when not. Again, from the Torah's perspective, what about a spouse? Where does a spouse fit in within the Torah's perspective? So the Rambam writes in the first chapter of Hilchos Nachlos, source 23, page 9, the Rambam writes in Perek Aleph Halacha Ches, Ha'isha eina yoreshes es ba'ala klal. A woman does not inherit her husband whatsoever. From the Torah perspective, a woman does not inherit her husband. Ha'ba'al yoreshes kol nechse ishto, midivrei sofrim, v'hu kodem lako b'yirushasa. A husband inherits his wife, but even that's not biblical. So the Rambam is acknowledging or conceding that biblically speaking, neither spouse inherits the other, children inherit, and then you follow the line from there. But the Rambam then distinguishes and says, the wife doesn't inherit the husband even rabbinically, but the husband does inherit the wife rabbinically. Fine. So that is the Rambam's perspective. The Ravid, Omar Avram, Eini Mode Bezeh, he says, I disagree. I don't concede. Why? So the Ravid here weighs in and disagrees, as does the Kesef Mishnah. Kesef Mishnah's commentary on the Rambam says, that it's rabbinic that a husband inherits his wife. So when the Rambam said that a husband inherits his wife, did he mean it rabbinically? So the Magen Mishnah says maybe he means it rabbinically. But the Kesef Mishnah says no. Sometimes the Rambam employs the term divrei sofrim not in order to suggest that something is rabbinic, but sometimes the Rambam employs the term divrei sofrim to tell us the hermeneutical methodology, the biblical exegesis. What was the way in which we extracted the law? How do we know that a husband inherits his wife? We know it not from an explicit verse. We know it because we apply the hermeneutic principles. And that's what the Rambam calls divrei sofrim. Divrei sofrim doesn't mean it's rabbinic in nature. Divrei sofrim means how we know it. So there's debate within the Rambam himself. Does the Rambam believe that a husband inherits his wife biblically or rabbinically? But either way, the Rambam says a husband inherits a wife. A wife does not inherit her husband. What does she get? Oh, is this evidence? The Torah is misogynistic. The Torah is biased. The Torah discriminates against women. Only a husband inherits his wife. A wife does not inherit the husband. Of course not. Why? A wife is entitled, to be supported from the husband's estate until she remarries or demands the payment of her ksuba. When we say she doesn't inherit her husband, it doesn't mean she walks away with nothing. It means that if she has a lifestyle she's used to living, the estate needs to continue to pay that lifestyle. She doesn't inherit the principal of his estate, but her lifestyle continues to be supported from the estate itself. So even though when a man dies, biblically speaking, his son will inherit his estate, that son must continue to support the woman who's either his mother or his father's wife, but before or as he inherits, he only inherits minus what the estate is going to support for the wife. What about a daughter? What about a daughter? So the Torah we saw in Bamidbar and the Shulchan Aruch recorded that sons inherit, daughters, technically speaking, don't inherit. So what about a daughter? Shulchan Aruch here in Evan Ezer, Kuf Yud Gimel says, Misha meis v'niach bas, if a man dies and he leaves a daughter, then we try to estimate how much did the man inherit to give to the daughter for her dowry. In those days, a woman would come with a dowry that was on her shidduch resume. More important than her picture or her dress size was the size of her dowry until recently, because a woman would represent the dowry that would give her husband a head start on supporting her lifestyle. So we estimate how much the husband intended to provide for the dowry, even Ostin Law, and we give it. We know it from the friends, we know it from the references. And if he's already married off, though that's not English language, if he has already has a married daughter, we look at the dowry he already offered the married daughter, and we assume he intended to match that dowry for his other daughters, and that's what's provided for from the estate as well. So a daughter doesn't inherit if there are sons, but every unmarried daughter is entitled to 10% of the estate to be used for a dowry. That's what we estimate, 10% of the estate to be used for dowry. In addition, she is supported, just like her mother, from an estate until the age of bat mitzvah or until she's married. That's a funny until, either or, but there were times that a woman, I guess, was married, betrothed, even before her bas mitzvah, even before the age of maturity of 12. So when we talk about the Torah only entitles a son to inherit, not a daughter, or a husband inherits the wife, not the wife, the opposite, you have to remember that we're talking about in a framework and at a time where the man was not the primary provider, the sole provider. The man was responsible for providing, and the woman had other responsibilities and obligations that she brought to the marriage, but the financial obligation was exclusively on the man. And therefore, the laws of inheritance reflect needing to empower the man to be able to continue to provide. And the assumption was a daughter doesn't need to inherit her father. Why? Because she'll be taken care of by her husband, and her husband will inherit his father. But her brothers need to inherit the father because they need to be able to take care of their wives who will not bring money into the marriage. So the entire framework has to be understood against the backdrop of the assumption that the husband is not the primary breadwinner, he's the sole breadwinner. He exclusively bears the responsibility to provide, and therefore a daughter doesn't need to inherit, a son does. A wife doesn't need to inherit, but a husband inherits his wife. However, even within that framework, or consistent with that framework, a wife, while she doesn't inherit the principal, continues to be provided for by the estate until she collects her ksuba. If she collects her ksuba as a lump sum payout, so now she is divorced from the estate. That's what a ksuba is. You use a ksuba in a lifetime in the context of a divorce, or you could collect a ksuba also after one's demise. Because the ksuba is a divorce from the estate, you collect the lump sum payout and you're no longer provided for. A daughter, similarly, the daughter inherits 10% of the estate towards her dowry, and she's provided for. Her lifestyle is provided for. She's supported by the estate until she's either married, and now it's her husband's responsibility, or the age of bat mitzvah, in which it's assumed also that she can take care of herself. Now, the Shulchan Aruch continues, source 26. The Ramah, this is in Choshen Mishpat. Here, when we're talking in the Shulchan Aruch, we're not talking exclusively in Evan Ezer, we are back and forth. Shulchan Aruch says the following: Kolanosi nechasad lachem v'niach yorshim apishen yorshim noagin bo kshura, ein ruach hachamim nocha heimenu. If you give their money elsewhere and you don't leave it to your children, even if the children are not acting in a way that they deserve it, the rabbis are not happy with you. V'zochu hachirim b'chol ma'ashenasan lahem, and technically, if you leave it to the others, they're entitled to it. Umidas chasidus shelo lahay b'tzava shemavirim b'yirusha me'ayorash afilim ben she'en anoy kishur la'achiv achav anoy kishura. So, and the custom is not to testify, not to support a will which is going to redirect funds from the children, from the family, to others. And the Ramah here throws in, the Ramah adds, that the best thing in the world is to leave it to one's children. God is gifted, God is enabled, God has blessed a person with assets for their life, and the best way that they can help their children continue their ethical will, their vision, their dreams, of their values, is to also materially provide for them, which will enable them to be able to do it. So this brings us over to less than the Rambam, source 27. The Rambam Hilchos Nachalos, Ein Adam Yochel Hosh Mishe'en Oroi Liyosho, V'lo Lakor Yerusha Ben Ayosh Af Pishezem Mamon Hu. Now, when it comes to money, normally we have a concept called Tanai Shebe Mamon. Normally we have a concept called a condition when it comes to money. And normally a condition when it comes to money is binding. Tanai Shebe Mamon, Tanao Kayim. When there's a condition when it comes to money, the condition is met. So the question is, if a person is trying to ignore the prescription, the formula of the Torah, ignore that the eldest son gets a double portion, and ignore that daughters don't receive, and ignore the hierarchy and the order that we're supposed to follow, and a person says, well, here's my condition, here's I'm going to bequeath the money, do we say to Noachim, do we say the condition is fulfilled and we follow it, or do we ignore it? Do we follow the rule of to Noachim? So the Rambam says, Ein Adam Yachol Lohorish Mishen Oroi Liyosho. You cannot leave money to somebody who's not eligible, who's not in line to inherit from you. V'lo lakor hayirusha min hayoresh. And not to deny or uproot or nullify the inheritance from the designated person who should receive it. Afa pish is a mamon, even though this is mamon, and ordinarily we say tanai shebe mamon. Why should tanai shebe mamon not apply here in the case of nachla or yerusha? So the Rambam gives us the answer. If you remember 2 weeks ago, the last time we met, I told you to pay attention to these words. Lefi shenema beparshas nachlos v'hais levnei Yisrael lichukas mishpat. The pasuk said, let's go all the way back up. If you look in Bamidbar, the Torah, when it talked about the rules of nachla, the pasuk said at the very end, v'hais levnei Yisrael lichukas mishpat kasher tziva Hashem es Moshe. It should be for the children of Israel lichukas mishpat, a decree of justice for the Jewish people. So the Rambam is teaching, the Rambam is trying to explain, what do those words, chukas mishpat, mean? What did they mean? Why were they used? What they mean is, chukas mishpat, shechukah zu lod nishtana, ve'en atanai mo'abba. The reason the Torah used those words was to bevorn, was to make sure you understood that this was an exception to the normal rule. The normal rule is that a condition with money, the condition is observed. However, if the condition with money has to do with inheritance, then the condition does not help. Why? Chukas mishpat. Because of those words. Ben shetziva v'hubari, ben shetziva v'shchiv mira. Whether the person gives that instruction while they're healthy or while they're on their deathbed, ben apeh, whether they do it orally, ben bichsav, or they write it, eino mo'il. It does not work. Which brings us to our question, which we will begin now and continue with next time. So how does a civil will work? If you don't have a halachic will, not a halachic living will, but a halachic will, if your attorney is not familiar with the halacha, with Jewish law, and your attorney has not put the criteria, the conditions, your attorney has not drafted a will that meets the halachic standards, then do we follow the will or not? A person dies and they don't have a halachic will. All they have is an ordinary civil will. Do we follow that will or not? So the Rambam said, chukas mishpat. We don't follow Tanai Shebe Mamon. Normally a condition with money is observed, and not when it comes here. So what do we do? So maybe you'll say, well, it's a classic case of Dina de Machusa Dina. Dina de Machusa Dina means that Rav Schechter has a whole article in an old RJJ journal about this. Rav Schechter feels very strongly about it. It's partly why he's my Rebbe and I love him. Dina de Machusa Dina. The law of the land is halachically binding. You're not allowed to ignore the law of the land. You can't cheat on your taxes, and you can't cheat in business, and you can't cheat in traffic, and you can't cheat in any area of law with the CDC and with the health standards. The law of the land is halachically binding. Not just legally binding, but it's halachically binding. And that's very, very important. Dina de machusa dina. The question is, how far-reaching is dina de machusa dina? Dina, the law, de machusa of the land, is dina. That's our law too. Whatever is the law of the land is our law. So first of all, there are some caveats to that, however. The law of the land is not our law if it violates our law. So let's say the law of the land becomes that it's prohibited to give a bris to your son. We don't say the law of the land, dina de machusa dina, is your din. If the law of the land legislates that everybody needs to try bacon once in their life, so the law of the land would not become the law. If the law of the land is in clear contradiction to our law, it's not the law of the land. But let's say it's not in clear contradiction. So would you apply dina de machusa dina to the area of Yerusha? Do you say, if someone has a civil law, and they did not leave a halachic will, they didn't leave a halachic will, so then maybe dina de machusa dina. So the fact that your inheritors can go to court in order to collect on the will that's left, or they can follow the estate law, they could follow whatever the civil law is. So do you say dina de machusa dina? Maybe they're not in violation of halacha because they are leaning on dina de machusa dina. So the one who addressed this very famously is the Rashba, Shlomo ben Aderes. And the Rashba says the following, one of the great Rishonim, Spanish Rishonim. The Rashba addressed an interesting case. I have here the answer in source 28, but I didn't give you the question, so I'll tell you the question outside. The question was the following. Reuven's daughter Leah married Shimon and gave birth to a daughter. So Reuven had a daughter named Leah, and Leah married Shimon. Shortly afterwards, Leah and her daughter both died. Reuven then claimed, based on the law of the land, he had the right to the large dowry he had given Leah. So we talked about, it wasn't the size of your dress or your picture in your resume, it was a dowry. Leah had a large dowry from her father Reuven, and Shimon, of course, loved her for her personality, but also loved her for her dowry. Now Shimon dies, so does the child, Leah and the daughter die, Shimon's alive. So the father Reuven says, you know, that dowry, that's mine. I gave it to Leah so she'd get married, but Leah now died. And Leah's child died, so there's no one to inherit Leah. So to whom does the money go? Leah's money, should it go back to her father, Reuven, or should it stay with her husband, Shimon? So Reuven the father argued that dina de malchusa, that this is mine, the law of the land, it goes to a father. Shimon, on the other hand, said, what do you mean? The halacha is that a husband inherits his wife. And we saw in the Rambam, whether it's biblical or rabbinic, how you interpret Divrei Sofrim, does it mean that's simply the method with which we learn the law? Or does it mean that's actually the nature of the law? But either way, the Rambam says, and this is the halacha, a husband inherits the wife. So Shimon is invoking the halacha, husband inherits the wife. The Tati, the Abba, Reuven is invoking the law of the land. The law of the land is, the civil law is, the father takes back the money. So that was the question that was posed to the Rashba. That was the question. And the Rashba answers very sharply, and he says the following. The truth is that any condition with money, normally we follow the condition. However, maybe it's different when it comes to Nachla, when it comes to Yerusha. Let's skip down. Person has to be shocked. What kind of town, what kind of city are you living in? Is it a makom Torah? How did they give at all when the Torah prohibits something? How could you defer the Torah rule to follow the civil law? When is it dina de machusa dina? When it's complementing halacha, but it's not in conflict with halacha. But here it's in conflict. Torah says the husband inherits. Civil law says the father inherits. Who cares what the civil law says when it's in conflict with the halacha? So the Rashba rules that if Jews embrace the civil laws of the countries in which they reside, and they're going to resolve monetary disputes that way, it's going to lead to abandoning the Torah altogether. Follow my underlines. The words of the rabbis, they're like the fathers of the Jewish people. We have to listen. God forbid a holy people should follow these laws of the land. So when does he apply dina de machusa dina? Says the Rashba, dina de machusa dina applies for external matters. So how fast you can go down Palmetto Park Road or on I-95, or what tax bracket you fall in, how much taxes you have to pay, that's when the law of the land kicks in. But internal monetary issues, when a Jewish father is leaving money to Jewish children, parents, spouse, or siblings, that is an internal matter, not an external matter. So when it speaks to legislating our role in society, that's when dina de machusa dina kicks in, says the Rashba. my relationship with society, traffic, taxes, garbage pickup, health guidelines, CDC, that is external. That's my role in the greater society around me. So their civil law rules the day. But when it comes to an internal matter, so let's say a financial dispute between two Jews, those two Jews have to go to a Beis Din, not a civil court. When it comes to the laws of inheritance, that should be resolved by what Jewish law says, not what civil law says. That is considered an internal matter, not an external matter. And therefore the Rashba argues very vehemently and vociferously that what would become of our holy books? If you're going to sin, you're going to make the terrible mistake of uprooting the inheritance of parents towards children, and you're going to lean on this shaky branch, the walls of Torah will fall down, and so anyone who uproots our sacred Torah, what would become of our Torah, the Mishnah, the Talmud, God forbid such a thing would happen, lest the Torah wrap itself in the sackcloth of mourning. He goes on and on, very strong language. And he says, anyone who places the law of the land, the civil law, over the halacha is making a terrible mistake, and they're a gazlan. So in other words, listen carefully. If you don't have a halachic component to your will, and all you have is a civil will that says, I want all my children, sons and daughters, to inherit equally. My firstborn son, no double portion. My daughters get as much as my boys. And you have no halachic component to it. You have no halachic addendum to it, which we will get to eventually. What that halachic addendum, it's as much as a paragraph, that's all it takes. But if there's no halachic addendum, all there is a civil law, civil will, with no halachic component, says the Rashba, you're a gazlan. The daughter who takes that money is stealing from her brother. The mother who takes that money is stealing from her son. It's a gazlan, the gzela yashiv, and they have to pay it back. And this is in fact codified by the Ramah in Choshen Mishpat Shin Samach Tes. And here the Ramah writes the following. The Ramah says, so small I can't read it. Hadar mina dina de machusa, davar sheesh bohana lamelach, o shehu ketarkanas b'nei medina, avalo b'dina akum dimkein, Batlu kol dina Yisrael. He's quoting the Rashba. And the Ramah, Moshe Issel, is quoting the Rashba, says that when do we apply dina de machusa dina? The traffic laws and the tax laws and the health laws. That's when we apply dina de machusa dina, because that is the interest of the government, the interest of the greater society. But internal matters, such as internal financial disputes or the internal inheritance, laws of inheritance, that dina de machusa, civil law, has nothing to say and is not binding. And the Rashba's conclusion was it would leave one a thief if they follow the civil law and ignore the halacha. What we're going to continue with next time is Rav Moshe saw it differently. Rav Moshe was a das yachid. And Rav Moshe wanted to know the following. And I'll just pose to you the question. And then we have a wonderful privilege the next year of Michal Zilberman of the Beis Din of America, Cases from the Beis Din of America. A great honor and a great privilege to have Rabbi Zilberman share his tremendous knowledge of how Batei Din work. So Rav Moshe was dealing with the following. Somebody died, and he didn't have a halachic will, he only had a civil will. So you can imagine, the ones who stood to benefit in the civil will, they said, we have to follow the civil will. The ones who stood to benefit from halacha's prescription said, how could you follow a civil will? It's keneged halacha. It's considered a gazlan. You're stealing from me. So the question is, should they follow the civil will or the halacha? Is the civil will that doesn't include the halachic addendum, is it nevertheless halachically binding? And here Rav Moshe was essentially a das yachid. Rav Moshe is all but a singular opinion. Rav Moshe all but goes against everybody else. And we'll pick up with that, please God, next time. But stay tuned as the afternoon kollel continues.